On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Slate Money is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. Casper mattresses come with free delivery and returns within a 100-day period. And right now, get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/slatemoney and using the promo code SLATEMONEY. And by Volvo, encouraging you to experience the wonder of summer. Have a month's payment on Volvo and spend your summer doing the things that matter to you. Plus, get up to 5 years full coverage, including wear and tear, by going to volvocars.com/US. And by Mile IQ, the app that automatically tracks and logs your miles, making sure that every dollar is accounted for and leaving you to focus on what's important. Try Mile IQ for free today by texting MONEY to 89800. That's MONEY to 89800.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Technical Difficulties edition of Slate Money. If you can manage to make it to the end of this edition without us stuttering out, you are probably doing quite well. Slate Money, as you know, is your guide to the business and finance news of the week. As you know, I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. As you know, I have the Kathy O'Neill here from MathBabe.org.
Hi, Felix.
And Slate's Moneybox columnist, Jordan Weissman.
Hello, Felix.
But what you don't know until right now, because I'm going to tell you, is what are we going to talk about? We are talking about stocks in China. They kind of fell off a cliff. That was fun. If you're a reporter, you get to write crazy headlines about stocks falling off a cliff. Financial journalists love to do that. But
other people might not agree.
Is this something that that hurts people? Is this a harmful thing? We will talk about this. We will also talk about restaurant reservations. There's got to be a better way. And Jordan may or may not have a better way. And first, because China's stock market is too far away, we are going to talk about the New York Stock Exchange.
Right. Well, so here's the thing. The New York Stock Exchange died for 4 hours or so. For a technical difficulty, a glitch, which we're only now learning about. The same day, we also saw a bunch of airplanes grounded, United airplanes, all of them were grounded. And the same day as those two things, we also saw the Wall Street Journal website go down. And the question is...
And Zero Hedge.
Oh, and Zero Hedge. Yeah. I can't believe I forgot that one. The question is this a coincidence?
Is it a conspiracy? Or is it a conspiracy?
Running theory at Slate was that Godzilla was finally coming. That was the electromagnetic field from Gojira himself coming to restore balance to the environment. That was our That was our theory.
Felix, what do you think?
I am a firm believer in Occam's razor, that the simplest explanation is always the correct one, and the simplest explanation is, oh, computers failed. So it was, yeah, just coincidence.
Right. So I have a slightly different take on it, which is that it seems like a coincidence that three things happen in one day. But my theory is that like hundreds and maybe thousands of things happen every day. And the question is...
Yeah, actually, my own personal computer at home, like the hard drive failed. But, you know, I mean, is it all connected?
And what I mean by thing, you know, is like a larger scale event on a computer system. Anybody who's ever worked at a software company knows what I'm talking about. It's like, you know, on a daily or weekly basis, something really bad happens and only, hopefully, cross your fingers, only like hundreds of people get burned by it. So the only thing that was exceptional about this day, was it Tuesday? I want to say
Wednesday.
It was Tuesday. Wednesday. The only thing exceptional about Wednesday is that three of the hundreds of things were noticed by lots and lots of people.
But it wasn't that exceptional in that, like, United Airlines has random problems all the time. They had another outage last month. And what's more, the New York Stock Exchange thing, although it sounds bad, and it was occasioned quite happily for a wonderfully deranged dystopian fantasy in The Guardian by Molly Crabapple, which I can highly recommend everybody reads. It actually had absolutely no effect on markets whatsoever. So, you know, it's not like stocks stopped trading or anything like that. We have a dozen different stock exchanges, probably actually many dozens if you include the various dark pools, and the stocks just kept on trading. The volume was untouched. No one really noticed, except there was lots of Twittering.
So I think what you're saying, if I may generalize what you just mentioned, is that as long as there's backup systems, we don't need to worry about one-off software glitches.
Well, no. I mean, I think worrying about software glitches is something we should do, because as software becomes increasingly complex and it only ever goes in one direction, we are going to have more failures. And that is a thing that's going to plague our lives for the rest of our existence. And sure, you can worry about that, although there's really nothing you can do about that. So maybe you shouldn't worry about that. But what you shouldn't do is suddenly jump to crazy conspiracy conclusions and like Josh Brown on Twitter and say it's a Chinese cyber warfare hack, you know.
Yeah, so why do we jump to conspiracy conclusions?
I think there's this growing sense that the more connected things become, there's the greater chance of a systemic failure, right? A big systemic failure. And I think it's actually the ex-president of Intel, I want to say, has written about this maybe, or a few people have talked about this at length, how as markets get more connected, right, just through the computers that run them, the chances that there's going to be one huge just glitch that makes everything go to hell rises. And so people get antsy. I think that's really the bottom line.
Actually, I don't think that's the conspiracy theory.
No, you're not.
But that's not a hack, right? That's not like malicious necessarily.
Well, we're also frightened antsy creatures too on top of that.
What we saw with the flash crash is you don't need any malign actor to cause, you know, crazy shit to happen in the markets.
Okay, so you're asking why specifically do we conclude it's China out to get us?
Why are people looking for a cause always? Why are they always saying, "Oh, this is cyber warfare. This is, you know, Godzilla rising from the deep."
Felix,
why
aren't, do people we're getting want we're about to get really deep here. This is like questions about life and God and the universe. Why do we need a cause for everything?
Well, it is actually kind of about God, right? I mean, it's like, why do we need explanations for things? My opinion is that I'm going to make a short list, maybe slightly longer than short, of really good reasons this stuff just happens, and that we do not have to ask about hackers or China. Not to say that there are no hackers in China, but besides what we just mentioned, which is that there's more interaction and there's more, as the code touches more things, one piece of code can also mess up a lot of things. That's actually what we ended up happening at the New York Stock Exchange. They tried to upgrade some software and the upgrade didn't work. And that is just so common, right? Like everyone's looking.
Pretty much explains every single stock exchange glitch that I can remember for the past decade.
Like night trading,
bats, and night trading. When the Nasdaq completely couldn't cope with the Facebook IPO, all of those things were basically related to software upgrades, which didn't work.
Why are they so bad at software upgrades?
Because software upgrades are hard.
Well, let me tell you a little bit more about software upgrades.
You're about to get into it.
It's important to think about building a software system the way you build a building. So you know how we discussed a few weeks ago, like airports and how they're terrible? American airports are terrible, especially like JFK. And the reason is they're terrible is they started out small and then you added shit onto them. And then they got like really ugly and they all look like high school gymnasiums. It's the same way with code, especially with startups. What you do is it starts at startups. You have some kind of code base and you're doing something quickly. You're just sort of throwing something together to see if you can get an archetype that works. And then it does kind of work and you're like, oh, let's just go on with this. And you add stuff on and you tape it with like duct tape, sort of the code equivalent of duct tape. And it's never been done. It never started out well.
And even if it did start out well, by the time you've added this to it and added that to it and 18 different companies have merged and it's got to 20 or 30 years old, then it's going to be a complete mess.
I just want to thank you for saying merged, because I think one of the most critical things that people don't realize...
And this explains United Airlines, by the way.
...is when you have a merger or an acquisition, what you often see is the best engineers are like, screw this, I don't want to be in a big company. And they leave, and then no one actually understands how things work.
And this isn't just software either. For instance, the London Underground was built really, really well back in Victorian times. But it's basically impossible. And if you wanted to build a whole brand new subway line from scratch in London, you could do that. What you can't do is extend the existing system or build onto it. You know, what you can't do is build the Second Avenue subway in New York, because you have to connect into the old system, and connecting into old systems is just orders of magnitude harder than building something new.
This is the phrase the coders use for this is a kludge. It's where you're basically using duct tape to make to patch something rather than create an elegant new system. And it's a really useful concept, like you were saying, beyond even coding or architecture. People have extended it to talking about political philosophy. Essentially, the entire U.S. policy apparatus is now one big kludge after another, trying to fix things we have in place.
Code, yeah. By its nature, can only become more complex. You can't simplify these things much as, you know, Rand Paul and the rest of them would love to. You know, the reason why the Exchange Act of 1933 was simple and the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010 was it?
Yeah,
was complicated. It was not because, you know, the politicians are malign and they just want to make everything complicated. It's just because over time, everything becomes more complicated. And you don't get that luxury that we had in 1933 of basically starting from scratch.
I'd argue there was a little bit more going on with the Dodd-Frank bill. But I just want to go bring it back to code for a second.
Yeah.
This is kind of a funny story, and I don't want anyone to get too alarmed because my brother is very funny. My brother works for the Department of Transportation as a consultant, and he's for the last 20 years. And his job essentially was to help them move from Fortran to a more modern language. So it's basically, it's a lot like building an airplane while it's flying. You know, you have to change the air traffic control system while it's being run. And whenever anybody asks my brother about how he feels about it, he's like, I know I'm never going to fly again.
Okay. So the first lesson we have learned from this week's podcast is never get on an airplane. Although it has to be said that civil aviation has never, ever been safer. It's spectacularly, unbelievably safe. So that, you know, somehow we must be doing something right. We're going to move on. But first, we're going to say lovely things about our sponsor, which is Casper Mattresses. Basically, as we have mentioned on this show in the past, mattresses are a luxury product, and like most luxury products, mostly what you're doing is you're paying for, you know, luxury branding and through the nose, and it's kind of silly. What Casper has done, which is great, is they've made a super luxury mattress, but they've given up on the whole, like, you know, we're just going to charge you through the nose for it and baffle you with marketing speak. We're just going to sell really good mattresses for really low amounts of money, and then everyone can have a great mattress. It's kind of simply as simple as that. They have premium latex foam. They have memory foam. They combine it. It's like foam mattresses are where you want to go. Don't pay thousands of dollars. Honestly, it's not worth it. Buy a Casper mattress. They start at $500 for a twin, $600 for a twin XL, all the way up to a mere $950 for a king. This is not much money. So go ahead, do it, because guess what? If you don't like it, you can send it back. You have 100 days to try it out, lie on it, sleep on it, have sex on it, do anything you like on it, and then after 100 days, if you don't like it, you can send it back. They'll give you your money back. They'll do all of the shipping and everything. It's great. Oh, and did I mention? They're made in America. We can be patriotic, or we would be if we were American. So get $50 off. That $950 king-size mattress is, in fact, only a $900 king-size mattress if you go to casper.com/slatemoney and use the promo code slatemoney, which I know you're all going to do right now, because sleeping is important. Just ask Arianna Huffington. I'm going to move on, though, to the Chinese stock market.
What is going on?
Oh, so much.
The Chinese stock market, it is crashing. Well, towards the end of the week, it ostensibly stabilized and even went up.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to last, but
anyway.
But
that's mainly because half of the stocks are suspended. So, you know, once they start trading again, you know, it's almost certainly going to go down again rather than up. The Chinese stock market, if you look over the past few weeks, has just plunged. It's down about a third. That's a massive crash. And a lot of people in China are losing a lot of money, and this is a bad thing. Now, The first thing which people are going to say here, I can hear you sitting in your cars listening to your podcasts and saying, but it's up on the year, or it's up on the, but it's still up 80% in the past 12 months or something like that. And the answer is yes, it is. If you are one of those Chinese people who has a, you know, buy and hold long-term stock portfolio, which you've been sitting on and not touching for the past year, then you're fine. Those Chinese people do not exist.
Yeah. Tens and tens of millions of people were jumping onto the market just as it was cresting. This was not a pretty affair.
And what's new about this is that this is not the rich Chinese people who are the only people who owned stocks up until a few months ago. This is this massive, like, stampede of very normal middle-class Chinese people jumping into the stock market with both feet, borrowing from their grandparents, borrowing on margin, often having 5-to-1 leverage to buy stocks. You're a mathematical sophisticate here, Kathy, so you can answer me this question. If you buy stocks with 5-to-1 leverage and they drop by 25%, what happens to you?
You're in debt.
So actually, can we talk a little bit more about buying on margin? Because that's key to understanding everything that's going on here.
What does it exactly look like?
Yeah. So, I mean, buying on margin is very simple. It's you're borrowing money from your broker to buy stock. That's the core of what it is. And then the problem with it is, the upside is, since you've borrowed money, if prices go up, you make more money. But if prices go down, your broker can ask for more collateral. The problem is, if you don't have any more money to give them, they then sell your stock.
This is basically you're taking out a mortgage, only instead of buying a house, you're buying a stock.
Exactly.
And stocks are a lot more volatile than houses.
So here's what I'm confused by. People who invest in the stock market in this country do not, generally speaking, borrow money to invest, like normal people.
We did in 1929.
So I guess, as somebody who might use E-Trade, I don't borrow money from a broker at E-Trade to invest.
Although you could.
There are
people who do. And generally, the people who do it tend to prefer to trade options rather than cash stocks for boring reasons, but mainly because you can get more leverage that way. So there are a bunch of people, and I remember, 1999 and 2000, where people were like day trading options on tech stocks. That was effectively leverage trading. But yeah,
but most people, I was going to bring it back to that, like the dot-com bubble. Most people like made way too much money and then lost all that money. And it wasn't that much of a tragedy. It sounds like because the Chinese average people have actually borrowed money, this is very tragic for them.
Any individual who's done it there are millions and millions of individual Chinese people who are now deep in debt. And what's more, the brokers who lent them all of the money, they now have huge numbers of bad loans on their books, which they're probably not going to be able to collect on. So there's a big, what we've done is we've taken an equity, stocks go up, stocks go down, no harm, no foul, and we've turned that into a really nasty kind of credit crunch and debt problem. And that's the wrong way around. What you want in capital markets is for bad debts to get equitized, debt for equity conversions, and if you lend money to a company and they can't pay you back, then you get stock in the company, that kind of stuff. And what's happened in China is exactly the opposite.
The other thing that's important to realize here is, because the market was driven by all this borrowed money, that's exacerbated the fall. Because what happens when you buy on margin is that if prices go down, your broker sells some of your stock, essentially to cover your debts, to cover your losses. The more the market falls, the more the brokers sell, and so it becomes
feedback loop.
It becomes a feedback loop, exactly. And so that's been driving the market downward.
Although there is a way of helping to prevent that, which the Chinese government has done, which is just banning selling.
Yes, they've literally banned major shareholders from selling their shares for 6 months.
I'm glad you brought up the Chinese government, because they typically are seen as they have a heavy hand, right? So if they're so micromanaging of their economy, why did they allow so many people to borrow money and then invest?
So this is, I was talking to a hedge fund manager about this a few days ago, and he was saying this was a completely unforced error on the part of the Chinese government, that they could see this happening. They tried to stop it from happening. They obviously didn't try hard enough. It kind of happened to them despite the fact they didn't want it to happen, and now they're in big trouble and they don't really know how to respond, and it's really messy. And the big consequence here that I worry about is just that this Chinese government, especially the current Chinese government, which is particularly micromanaging, is going to conclude that they don't really have control of the economy. And then they're going to basically take a big step backwards so that they can have a simpler economy, or maybe a smaller economy, but one that they can actually have genuine control over.
I think there's also... I have another answer for the why did they do this. First off, there's some evidence that they were kind of working at cross purposes. Margin trading was actually banned for a while in China, and then they kind of loosened the rules, partly because they wanted to build up their equity markets. China's businesses rely heavily on bank loans, right? And right now, there's a massive debt bubble, a corporate debt bubble building in China. One of the ways that the government thinks that they can undo that is by getting companies to basically fund themselves by going public. So, but in order to do that, you really need a thriving stock market. So they thought, okay, we're going to loosen the rules. You'll have more of a market, and eventually something will develop. The problem
let me slow it down.
Yeah.
They realize that there's a big corporate debt problem, and they were trying to unravel that by saying we need more participation in the stock market.
In general, stocks are safer than loans. You know, bad loans can really destroy an economy, whereas a stock market crash, as we saw in the United States in 2000, is not that big of a deal.
Yep.
And frankly, even in China, the stock market crash is not that big of a deal, even though it does have these kind of debt-related repercussions. In and of itself, the deep underlying engine of the Chinese economy is probably not going to be greatly affected. The worry is not economic here. The worry is political. The worry is that the Chinese government is going to get scared off from whatever kind of financial liberalization it might have had in mind.
I think that's mostly right, that it is primarily not an economic concern, primarily political. That said, there are some economic feedbacks here as well, in the sense that a lot of everyday Chinese are now scared shitless of the stock market. And the government is also, again, not quite sure how to regulate this thing they're trying to create. It may just be that China's equity markets are going to be underdeveloped for a very long time. And in order to become a real rich nation, you need thriving securities and equity markets and all these things.
You do? I mean, I think Germany became a thriving rich nation without thriving equities markets. I feel like it's not that hard. I feel like France did it. I mean, why is it so important? I feel like America is really the only thriving rich nation, and possibly the UK, which is built on public stock markets.
Europe relies more on bank debt, but I think that they certainly, I don't think it's grown up independent of an equities market. None of those countries, they've had them.
China has them as well. But I just don't think
But China's is barely functioning at this point. This is the whole point. China's is not... Aside from the volatility that we've seen, this isn't China's first big crash. It also doesn't, you know, their public markets are barely regulated in terms of things like accounting. I mean, it's just very... The fundamentals that underpin the way companies work in the U.S., partly because we have these markets that have certain standards, just don't exist in China.
I will remind you that Alibaba went public in the United States precisely because the accounting standards in the United States were lax enough because it couldn't rise to the accounting standards that were necessary to list in China.
I believe it was Hong Kong.
China or Hong Kong. Neither Chinese nor Hong Kong markets would accept Alibaba with its current accounting standards, but the Americans did. So it's not quite as clear cut as all that.
Well, it does seem like things are happening quickly, and things are whatever's going on in China. There's a lot of interference by the Chinese government, and they're playing all sorts of tricks. Like, for example, I remember the day that it looked like Greece was really, the Grexit was due, right? It was imminent. And for whatever reason, the Chinese gave the banks a lot of money or the brokerages. I don't know what happened, but
for some reason,
the Chinese stock market went way up that day when everybody else was tanking. I mean, they're just doing everything, it seems like, to try to control things right now.
So next week, we will... I mean, I feel like for the past 3 months, I've been thinking to myself, next week we will talk about Greece, because finally we will have a pretty good idea.
They have a Sunday deadline. Like, we really, this is...
Every week there's a Sunday deadline.
Last week they did,
and then every week we're like, no. Did we say last Sunday? We meant next Sunday. I have a reasonably strong feeling that this week we might actually have a genuine Sunday deadline and have a feel for whether we're Grexiting or not. But yeah, this week... we're not going to talk about Greece. We are going to talk about restaurant reservations, but before we do that, we are going to talk about Volvo, because the second sponsor of today's podcast is Volvo. All I can say is this is a really good summer it's turning into. And what you do in a really good summer is you get in your car and you drive around America and you go camping and you go explore this amazing continent that we are so blessed to live in. And the best way to do that is in a brand new Volvo, where you get a month's payment on Volvo and you get to enjoy yourself and your family and your dog, if you have a dog, because dogs love Volvos. It's true. You also get 5 years full coverage, including wear and tear. It's an awesome wonder of summer event from Volvo. So go to volvocars.com/US, test drive a Volvo. You'll love it. Jordan, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Why do restaurants, which put so much effort into giving me like a great, great experience on the plate, why do I have such a horrible experience when it comes to things like paying for the check and reservations and all that kind of stuff?
Are you saying why do they have like no technological skills? Why is no one figured out a way to smooth this out with an app?
Well,
are you asking that? Is that what you're asking me, Felix? Are you trying to lead me with that? Is that what you're...
Look, so here's... I have
an answer to that.
I have many problems with restaurants. Yeah,
I don't have any problems with restaurants. I'm sorry, but what are you talking about? What kind of restaurants are we
talking
about?
Okay, so we're kind of...
Let me start with the story.
Okay.
I have a story today. My wife's 30th birthday is coming up, and as a... I've been wanting to take her out to 11 Madison Park. It's a fancy restaurant in New York. She's always wanted to go. Felix is making a face at me. We can argue about this later.
We'll talk about the whole, like, you know, 11 Madison Park class of restaurants,
Anyway,
at some point.
Eyebrows have been raised.
He has raised his eyebrow. I could give less of a fuck. But anyway, so I was trying to make a reservation. First time I called, couldn't get through. Couple days later, you have to make a reservation 28 days in advance with this place.
Exactly. Can't be 27.
Well, it can technically, but as I found out one day when I tried to call 27 days in advance, they had nothing. They were totally book solid. So then I tried another time. I ended up on hold. They opened the reservations line at 9 a.m. I was on hold for 25 minutes before I gave up. I threw in the towel. Finally today, I looked at my clock, and as it hit 9, I pressed call. And I managed to get to the reservationist after 15 minutes on hold, but finally managed a 6:30 reservation on a Friday. So this is the experience that some restaurants think is efficient, or the way they go about.
And this is my question, because 11 Madison Park is not any longer owned by Danny Meyer, but it was for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And Danny Meyer is legendary for being the service guy. All he cares about is customer service. All he cares about is making you feel absolutely wonderful. If a Danny Meyer restaurant, and frankly, 11 Madison wasn't that different when he was running it in terms of reservations, gives us such a miserable experience, isn't there something wrong here?
Can I make a completely disagree with you guys? Let me make the argument for why this is exactly the right system. First of all, they don't have space for 4,000 times as many people, right? So there has to be some way of keeping it exclusive. And second of all, if people are willing to wait 15 minutes on hold and remember exactly what time to call, et cetera, then they're guaranteed to get people who really want to be there. I think from their perspective, like, hey, this works.
This is
capitalism, Kathy. Why can't we just do this the obvious way, which is... let people pay.
Excuse me, but I just want to make the point also that the fact that you worked for it makes you more willing to pay, makes you love the experience more.
Let me bring us to our topic. So there's a startup right now called Tock, and there's a big article about it.
That's T-O-C-K, not T-A-L-K.
As in TikTok, Tock.
Yeah.
And there's a big article about it in GQ. Business Week has written about it before. And it's founded by this guy named Nick Kokonis. He is he owns some restaurants in Chicago with a chef named Grant Aschatz, Alinea Next. They're like big food world restaurants. And what they kind of pioneered there was a ticket system. Instead of, you know, calling and hoping to God you could get through after 20 minutes, they let you basically prepay for your meal, like, and just go online and, you know, see what tables are open and put down your money. And the idea being that this was easier for customers, but also good for the restaurant, because restaurants are constantly dealing with the problem of no-shows. People just, even if it's a couple people a night, someone inevitably will skip their reservation without warning. And this costs the restaurant money. It drives up prices for them. It drives up the prices for all the other customers because they have to compensate. And even though it's only a few people each night, over time, it has a big cumulative effect. Nick Kokonis has now created this company called Talk, where he's trying to take this ticketing system national, where essentially you can pay for a restaurant reservation the same way you would buy a movie ticket, and presume, and most of the time, the money that you pay ahead of time will just be folded into the cost of your meal. But the idea is people won't skip because either they've entirely prepaid or there's some sunk cost, as far as they know.
And then the other thing which he's done, and I think kind of the more interesting innovation that he's made, is he has realized that there's something, as Jordan's little anecdote shows, there's something incredibly valuable about a restaurant reservation. And yet the reservation itself has historically always been given out for free. That anyone can get a reservation, at least in theory, just by picking up the phone or going onto OpenTable or anything like that. And no one actually believes that the value of a restaurant reservation at 8 o'clock on a Friday night is the same as the value of a reservation at 6:30 on a Monday, and that the value of both reservations is zero. But that is the world that we have been kind of pretending that we live in. And it makes perfect sense for there to be a market in restaurant reservations, and that a reservation at a peak time might cost more than a reservation at a not off-peak time, rather than always charging exactly the same amount for just the food.
I think you guys know what I'm about to say.
Kathy looks so angry right now.
The commodification of restaurant reservations just makes me really angry, because it makes me feel like, well, at the very least, this is a democratic process. Whoever gets on the phone, I mean, you have to have a phone. But at the very least, if someone really, really wants it, they can do it. But what you're describing, it sounds like it's quickly going to move towards just like only rich people will ever get to eat. Like super. Now, obviously, you have to be pretty well off to eat at one of these places, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. It strikes me
No, Kathy, it's actually much more democratic, because what it means is that, you know, if you don't want to pay the extra $50 for a peak reservation, then you save $50 by not doing that.
I mean, that's a good way of saying it. But let me ask you this. Why don't the restaurants just charge way more for 8 o'clock dinners on Friday nights?
Okay, so that's the thing, because there's this convention that the menu is fixed. And this goes back all the way to, basically a printing thing, that you print a menu with prices on it, and you can't show different prices depending on the time of day or time of evening. But, you know, there have always been quasi workarounds. You know, they've had free corkage on Mondays, or they've had blue plate specials if you come in before 7 o'clock, or this kind of thing. And so there are ways that they effectively, you know, try and like encourage people to come at off peak times, but it's clearly not enough. And simply charging more at peak times, as David Chang does at Mama Fukuko and stuff like that, is smart.
Yeah.
If you go to the extreme and make it like a truly free market, like who's going to pay for what on Friday at 8 o'clock?
Well, they're not turning it into an auction system quite yet.
You could,
if you really wanted to go there. So the more common objection to this system is, okay, it'll work for Momofukuko, it'll work for 11 Madison Park. It's not going to work for your Chinese takeout down the street, or like your American Chinese place down the street, or a more mid-tier restaurant. One of the interesting things that the guys trying to pioneer is just kind of having different types of tickets. So the idea is maybe you don't entirely prepay for your meal, but you just have some sort of a ticketing system that makes it work better than OpenTable, essentially.
I will tell you one thing, which actually OpenTable does well, and a couple of other companies like Resy and Reserve do well, and really does apply to everyone, not just to the high-end restaurants. And that is the misery of the whole check theater at the end of the meal. That you've had your lovely meal, you've finished your last drop of wine, and then there's that whole thing where you're waiting to catch someone's eye and you're waving your hand around and you say, can I have the check please, and they go away and you wait a whole bunch more extra time, and then the check comes and they disappear, and you look at the check and you put your card down and you wait for them to come, and you wait for them to come and pick it up, and then they disappear again, and you wait a bit further and they come back, and then you work out the tip, and it's horrible. And especially lunch.
Suffering.
We considered calling this episode First World Problems, just so you know.
Jesus.
We thought about it.
Sometimes you've got you know,
you're drunk. You had three rosés.
Imagine this is like a pre-theater meal, and you actually have to get to the theater on time.
I know, Felix.
Or you have a train.
What
to catch.
We need is like an Uber app for eating.
And that is exactly what Open Table and Resy and Reserve have done. That if you just make your reservation on one of these apps, or there's this app called Cover, which I use quite a lot, which is great for this. You just check into the restaurant on Cover, or you check into your Open Table reservation if they've hooked in like this, and then you eat, and then once you eat, you leave, and then they have your card on file, and there's you just say, I'll add a 20% tip, and it's all done. You get to leave, and it's painless. It's just like leaving an Uber, and that's great.
The first time Felix and I ever met, we went to lunch, and he showed me he was paying the bill, and it was like a magic trick. Like he like held up his own, look at this, and like pressed the button.
You know, I don't think you ever took me to lunch, Felix.
I will take you to lunch. Nice. I will make sure we use it. Resy.
You brought up Resy though. See, there's a whole other class of companies kind of on the other side of talk that have kind of, I think, caused a bit of outrage among consumers, especially in San Francisco, where I think, if I'm not mistaken, Resy is one of them, where essentially instead of working with the restaurant, like letting the restaurant sell its own reservations, what they do is they just poach reservations and then scalp them back.
No.
That's not Resy.
Resy is not poaching.
They don't poach?
No, there is a poaching one.
Poaching ones, but Resy is not.
Resy's not poaching. Okay, so I'm glad you corrected me.
No, Resy and Reserve, they work with the restaurants to, you know, hold back some prime tables, which all restaurants always do, by the way. This is not anything new. And just saying, like, we can help you get those prime tables on short notice, which otherwise you wouldn't be able to get.
Okay, so I forget the name of the poacher. I forget the names of the poachers, but there is this whole other class of apps that have opened, and all they do is act as middlemen, where they buy up, they get reservations for free.
They're like scalpers.
And they scalp
them. This is yet another reason why reservations should not be free.
Yeah.
But in any case, I would urge you guys to, you know, maybe start thinking about this kind of thing because, it is a bit of a first world problem, but if we can make these problems less problematic, that's good for everyone.
I think I know why this problem doesn't occur to me because I just don't go to restaurants like that.
I also need to tell you about our third sponsor for this week's podcast, which I'm quite excited about. This one is Mile IQ. Now, there's a very, very good chance that this is the most valuable thing that you're going to hear on this podcast because a lot of you, most of you, I would say, spend a bunch of time in your cars and a lot of you have some kind of freelance, Schedule C income, this kind of thing. And did you know, well, you probably knew that in theory you can write off all manner of business-related car trips at 56 cents a mile against your taxes. Does anyone do that? No, because how on earth are you going to start adding up how many miles you drove on business versus how many miles you drove on other things? It's just impossible. Or at least it was impossible until this wonderful little app came along called Mile IQ, and you don't need to do anything at all. You install it on your phone and you forget about it. You don't need to, turn it on at the beginning of a trip and turn it off at the end of a trip. You just install it on your phone, and then every so often when you're waiting in line or something, you just swipe left to show that it's a personal trip, swipe right to say that it's business related, and then at the end of the year, it will add all of those business trips up for you. It will give you a clever little thing that you can hand to the IRS, and bang, you get... Okay, get this. The average Mile IQ user logs $535 of drives per month. Well, that's real money. So anyway, what you do, because you're probably listening to this on your phone anyway, pick up your phone, pull over. Don't do this while you're driving. Pick up your phone, text money to 89800. That's money to 89800, and you will... get Mile IQ. You can try it for free, and it will save you so much money, you will be blissfully happy for the rest of your life.
That's actually pretty...
It is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
All right, Kathy, what's your number this week?
My number is 87.5%, which is the amount of 2013 income that Puerto Ricans owe as a island. I'm not sure what to call them. Puerto Rico is in a lot of debt. It's kind of like the Greece of North America. They owe a huge amount of money per person.
$72 billion.
Per person, that's more than, that's 87.5% of a yearly income. So if everyone gave almost their entire yearly income towards the national, towards their debt, then they would get out of it. But that's compared to Hawaii, which is also deeply in debt and also poor, but they only owe 10.8% of their national income per person.
Puerto Rico needs to restructure its debt, but the problem is there's no bankruptcy regime to allow them to do it. Mm-hmm. We will talk much more about Puerto Rico in a upcoming episode. Jordan?
My number is $10, which I learned this week is how much you need to earn, adjusted for purchasing power, essentially, to be part of the global middle class, as loosely defined. We were talking about China today and all these middle class investors, and what exactly does that mean? Well, Pew had a report this week talking about the rise of the global middle class we've heard so much about in India and Brazil. And what you're essentially talking about in when you hear that, about, or what we're essentially talking about when we discuss those people are individuals who live on $10 to $20 a day per member of the household. It's not a lot of money. It's actually, you know, it's a reminder that just because we hear the middle class is growing around the world, that doesn't mean it's the American style middle class by any way, shape, or form.
And my number is 212, my favorite area code, except for it's not an area code. It's actually a number. It's 212. And it's the number of books, because this is my latest side project, which I need to tell you guys about because it's loads of fun. It's the number of copies of Trekonomics, which have been pre-ordered on inkshares.com. I'm helping to publish this thing. I have an imprint called Piper Text. So go to pipertext.com. We will have the author, Manu Saadia, on the show in August. I'm looking forward to this. But trust me when I tell you that the economics of Star Trek is kind of the most interesting thing you haven't really thought about.
Oh, my God. No, I've thought about it.
So interesting.
Oh, it is. It's amazing.
This thing is post-scarcity economics. Manu has written an entire book about it. It's a great book. It will be published once we get 1,000 pre-orders. We have 212 so far, so go on.
I'm there.
Are you going to pre-order a book?
I am.
Thank you, Kathy. Pipertext.com. All right. That's it for us this week. It was a thrillingly fast ride. I feel like we could zoom, zoom, zoom. This was a good one. Thank you for listening. Subscribe to the show so you can listen to more of these thrillingly fast rides in your car, which, you know, is a Volvo with Mile IQ installed. Yeah. We're in the iTunes store. Search for Slate Money. Write to us. The email address is slatemoney@slate.com. Oh, and one very important correction, which I need to put in, and thank you to Arnaud Hubert, who sent this in. Kathy, you asked me a question last week. You said, yes. Is every pink
thing.
Wine
yes.
a rosé? And I said, yes, every pink wine is a rosé because I live in a first world bubble. The fact is that every pink wine is not rosé. There is this truly abominable, horrible, sweet thing called White Zinfandel, which is the number one selling pink wine in America. Do not buy yourselves a bottle of White Zinfandel and pretend that you're drinking rosé. This will not end well.
I just want to deconstruct that whole spiel a little bit because Felix basically just said, I live in a first world bubble, so I forgot about White Zinfandel.
Which is the most popular
yeah. wine in America, thus suggesting most of America, implying that most
it's
of America.
More than a first world bubble, Felix.
Yeah, anyway.
I've never really considered America to be a first world country.
Oh my God.
Here we go. Anyway.
You don't get White Zinfandel in France, I'll tell you that for nothing.
All right, here we go.
Anyway, many thanks to Audrey Quinn for producing this week and to the managing producer, Joel Meyer, the executive producer, Andy Bowers. Slate Money is part of the Panoply Network. And if you listen to The Gist this week, I'm not only recording Slate Money today, I'm also recording The Gist. So you can listen to me on The Gist, which is the awesome podcast by Mike Pesca. But Mike Pesca is in Cartagena, I believe, right now. So I'm going to be standing in for him. So that's one of the awesome Panoply shows. Check out all of them, itunes.com/Panoply, and we'll talk to you next week on Slate Money.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.